Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, finally recovered enough from the hillside fog to be able to be on the air today. So no, it wasn't that bad.
Hillside fog, also known as...
A little bit of that, but you know, it's...
They had bigger cups this year.
Did they?
They look bigger.
I have an...
I didn't go, but... historical cup
that I take back.
Oh... Yep. Oh,
they
man.
Say, man, you've been here since before I was born. Yeah, one of those.
You got to represent.
Yeah, exactly.
Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can also listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. Today we're going to revisit the Cornwallis controversy, which is something I didn't think would exist in 2017. First, the Proud Boys came out to fight for the founder of Halifax, and now people are demanding the city take down the statue of its founder. Is it about time, or are we threatening to make up for history by trying to forget it? Then, despite all the other drama... and there is considerable drama. The Trump administration is moving forward with its plans to renegotiate NAFTA. A meeting will take place next month between the U.S. and Canada and Mexico. But is there any room for compromise when tensions are running so high? And then we will talk about the new Doctor Who, which is a lady, and pretty much the world ended for some people. and we were going to talk about why that's silly. But first, another month, another NDP leadership candidate came through town, this time in the person of Guy Caron. And I wasn't available to do the interview this time, Scotty. It was our intern, Scotty Hertz.
Veteran intern Scotty Hertz got called up from the minors where he's been languishing for a couple of years. Dug out the old recorder and blew the dust off it and found some decent batteries and let it rip. So, yeah, it's been a little while, but it was all right. I got back into it And once again, at the Red Papaya, which seems to be the place for NDP in town, there's a bit of a pattern emerging.
Or Breezy.
Corners. Oh, of course, Breezy Corners, the link is. And what is it for the conservatives when they come? It's Robusta, right? Or not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, the two of them came through town, Lisa Raitt and what's his name?
Bernier. It's been so long, he's done, right? Yeah. But did they both go to Robusta?
Yeah, they both did Robusta.
Okay, so this,
it's like it's the coffee shop. At the base of the condo tower.
Yep.
Across from Guelph Central Station.
I guess that's not to say we shouldn't actually specify that these businesses either are pro or con a certain political party. It's just weird that they pick the same places. I guess they have a certain
rapport.
Who knows? But
I think Red Papaya is, no disrespect to Red Papaya, usually a big empty.
On a Monday, yeah. Well, most things are, but...
So, there's room for people to come out, and then I don't know about Robusta. I've never stepped foot in there.
That's Me neither, and I walked by.
No disrespect to Robusta. I just haven't had a chance to pop by.
Yeah, we didn't come up with this bit just to slam business. That Robusta, I tell you, man, I know, right? It looks popular.
Coffee's still popular,
yeah.
It's still open.
I guess so.
Several
we should
months
go
after
for one of our next tour. It's like...
Yeah,
burger tour is long gone, so coffee tour next, and political coffee tour.
Yeah.
It's like, Billy Bragg drank a coffee here when he was here. I don't know, somebody. And then Lisa Raitt.
That would be interesting.
Then Lisa Raitt came. I don't know. But yes.
Maybe we should play the interview.
We should play the interview. definitely play the interview. The fog is lifting. Okay, this is Guy Caron, and he was here on Monday. That was definitely not Guy Caron who was here on Monday. That was the end of our theme music.
You know, we should have said that was a transition.
It was a transition. I should have just let it roll. Yes,
should have just let it roll. Yeah.
I was going to say the perils of live radio, but the challenges. But anyway, here is Guy Caron and Scotty Hertz.
I'm here with Guy Caron, one of the four candidates remaining in the race to be the next federal leader of the New Democrats. He's already won the award for the longest riding name. Can you just tell us which area you represent in Ottawa? Because I'm probably going to mess it up.
So. Yes, it's Rimouski-Neshet-Témiscouata-les-Basques, which is in eastern Quebec.
There you go.
My riding goes from the border of Maine and New Brunswick to the St. Lawrence River.
You tweeted something about the importance of visiting rural areas and smaller ridings in a way the NDP never has. Could you elaborate a bit on that? Is there a perception in some places that the NDP is an urban party? Or?
Yes, there is, and I've seen that. I mean, we're putting lots of importance in Toronto and Vancouver and Montreal, for example, and those areas are important. But we have been withdrawing from rural Canada, and I'm coming from a rural riding. Something I bring to this race is the fact that I know both realities very well. I lived half my life in Rimouski, which is an area, my riding is 85,000 people. Rimouski is 50,000 people, the largest east of Quebec City. But I've lived half my life in Montreal, in Toronto, in Ottawa. So I know both realities, and I do believe that you need someone with knowledge of both realities to be able to move towards unity in this country.
One of the key planks in your campaign is a concept that's getting a lot of attention lately, and you're proposing a version of is a guaranteed basic income for Canadians below the low income cutoff line, LICO, to bring them up that line, and consolidating some other benefit programs as a part of that. It's a pretty bold initiative. How do you intend to roll that out?
We have to understand that right now in this country, which is a wealthy country, we have 6 million people who are living under the low income cutoff, under the poverty level. And if you listen to conservatives, they'll tell you that it's their own fault. It's they're lazy, or it's their fault. 70% of those who are poor are working. They want to get away from poverty. And basic income will provide them with this possibility by ensuring that no one will live under the low-income cutoff. Everybody, for example, in Guelph, where the low-income cutoff would be about $19,000 at this point, will not have any less than $19,000 a year. If you're earning up to $16,000, then you'll get $3,000 added. If you have social assistance up to $13,000, then you'll have top up to help you reach at 19. And the reason is that that level is estimated according to what you need to not have to worry about your basic needs. And when you don't need to worry about your basic needs, the whole community benefits from it. We've seen pilot programs that showed in the past that basic income decreases crime rates, hospitalization rates, it decreases divorce rates. So as a whole, it's a plus for the community. Let's move in that direction, especially in a future where we'll have some displacement of labor, or some more difficulties in the future because of automation and because of the need to transition the economy towards an economy based on renewables rather than fossil fuels. All of this will bring about disruptions. Basic income will provide some stability in this.
So something else is always top of people's minds come election time is taxes and the various parties in that regard. Usually the complaints, they're too high, regardless of who's in power. You're also proposing what could be seen as like sweeping changes to the tax system, how they're collected, who pays, and et cetera. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, it's obvious to everyone that the system is broken. Not everybody's paying their fair share. We know lots of people who are not paying their fair share. And we need, from the start, to bring some balance in the system. The balance means that right now we're taxed on income and sales. Capital is not very taxed. And the problem with not taxing capital is that it's a main driver of economic inequality. So what I want to do is to ensure that we tax capital with a tax on estates, a tax on wealth, a tax on financial activities as well, to reduce the inequality that's in the system right now. And eventually all of this must be driving towards a full reform of the system, because, you know, we have a system right now that's been mostly designed in the mid-50s, before computers, before globalization. And it's broken. It leaks like a sieve. It facilitates tax havens. It facilitates tax evasion. Let's move away from that model. And let's attack tax evasion and tax havens at the same time.
So one of the personal values you mentioned on your election website is that you're tenacious and driven. And this is definitely reflected in your running for your seat in three elections.
And I think in the fourth.
That would have probably been enough for people to throw in the towel. But do you think that's one of your key strengths in the race, and potentially as prime minister?
I got plenty. The fact that I've worked all my life to ensure that Quebec progressives would work hand in hand with Canadian progressives toward the common good. I'm from Quebec, but I've worked with the street movement, civil society, and the labor movement all across the country. So I know the reality in Quebec. I know the reality in Ontario and in BC and the Prairies and Atlantic Canada. I've, as I said, lived in half my life in rural settings and half my life in urban settings. So I know both realities. So if you want a candidate, and you'll need a candidate that will be able to unite this party, that will be able to unite this country. My background, my past, provides very good references for me.
So something we've asked all the candidates who've been through town during the race, it's a bit of a two-parter. First of all, what makes you the best choice for federal NDP leader, and what do you think that makes the others in the race a good choice for leader?
On me, besides what I just said about what qualifies me, it's also the fact that I'm an economist. I understand economic realities, which always been the Achilles heel of the NDP. When liberals or conservatives want to attack us, they tell about this tax and spend party, and they tell about this this party that doesn't know how to manage, which is kind of weird because we have over $650 billion in debt right now, and not a single cent of this can be attributed to an NDP government. So all in all, I'm bringing economic credibility to the party, which is basically eliminating one of its main weaknesses. The three other people who are in the race, the funny thing is that we provide... We're all new Democrats. We all fight for the same thing. We're all in the same party because we all believe in justice. We all believe in the common good. We all believe in progressive values. We just all come from different perspectives. And you see that in the priorities we're setting. I set priorities that deal with the economy, that deal with poverty, for example, that deal with economic inequalities. When you're looking at the other candidates, they will be looking at social justice, social programs. So they'll be looking at, in the case of Charlie, for example, he's known as the great defender of indigenous rights. And he's the guy who wants to be seen as the average guy ready to defend everyone. Jagmeet brings some expertise in law, the fight against harassment, discrimination, and racism. Nikki is coming with a very strong background in fighting for youth and millennials. So we all come from different perspectives, which makes us all ideal candidates. I still do believe that to win the next election, we'll need not only a candidate that will be able to win in Quebec, because Quebec has been the key for the NDP, but also to give credibility to the party on economic issues.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Guy, and perhaps we'll see you in town again before October.
Absolutely, I would love to.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Way to go. You made him promise to come back before the leadership.
Listen, Guy, we got your number now, so you better come on. So we know that's 4 out of 5, although one is withdrawn. So the Peter Julian, you spoke to Peter Julian, of course you did.
Mm-hmm.
So that one, I guess, just doesn't get replayed, right?
Well, it's on our website.
Oh,
so it's on the podcast still. And you can go to our website. There's a tab there, past guests, and you can click on it, and it'll take you right to the episode that the person you want to hear from appeared on. Just
I'm finally
going to
be interviewing somebody on there. That's awesome.
Well,
or maybe not.
What do you mean?
Hertz gets cut. No,
I don't get jeez.
I'm trying to get back into the groove.
You want
here,
me to double your parts over?
No, it's like... That's right. I'll read your script there. Miss.
Oh man,
Miss Ashton, how are you? Yes, so we were trying to get all. I'm sure when Jagmeet Singh comes to town, we will.
Oh, he's got to come.
We will corner him at the Red Pie and make him come. No, that's not it at all. But we really appreciate them taking the time to speak with us, and we'd also extend that to any political parties out there. We've had a lot of people through here, but if there's anyone else that is interested in coming on, thinking about city councilors that haven't come on yet. Perhaps
there
might
are a
be
few.
Listening. There's a few.
There's a few, and they know
and
who they are.
We're staring right at you. We're at City Hall there. You know,
they know who they are.
We got your number, but the door is always open, so
think we know? We know!
You can contact us through the channels, and we'll definitely entertain all comers.
Sure. Speaking of all comers, I think that's a terrible segue, but what are we going to do?
It could be, but you're betting. 458.
Things in Halifax have kind of accelerated, and it was a couple of weeks ago on Canada Day that a group of Aboriginal protesters gathered in front of the statue of Edward Cornwallis and held a bit of a truth and reconciliation ceremony, because Cornwallis, founder of Halifax, also, you know, put a bounty on anyone who was of Indigenous descent when he was in charge there. That was interrupted pretty swiftly by a group called the Proud Boys. That caused a bit of a controversy. And things seem to have accelerated. Now people calling for the statue of Cornwallis to be removed entirely. They interrupted a city council meeting, a regular city council meeting, in Halifax this past Tuesday. And I'm of kind of two minds about this. It's like, yeah, these people... like Cornwallis, a lot of the Confederate statues that have been taken down in the United States lately. I mean, that's almost an entirely different subject altogether, but this goes along with the calls to change the name of Ryerson University, named by one of the architects of residential schools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my half my mind is like, yeah, those kind of were terrible people. Maybe it behooves us to try and rename things to be more reflective of something positive. On the other hand, I do wonder if, you know, we're trying to sort of wipe away the negatives of history. And you know, maybe history just generally is negative, because even somebody like Abraham Lincoln, a great emancipator, killed an awful lot of Aboriginal people.
Yeah, for sure. And this is the problem. I mean, he's regardless, he's the founder of Halifax, right? Yeah. There's nothing that can't be changed. But he was definitely not a good person at all. And I'll tell you, I sort of, people confuse this Cornwallis with his brother in the States, who was the one that surrendered to the Americans in the Revolution.
So I sure know the Proud Boys did.
Yes, both the Cornwallis, they came from money in the elite, and
you know, not related at all either.
They're brothers, aren't they?
Well, I thought they weren't related.
Edward and William. Anyway, there is a connection between the two. We'll say that for now, certainty. But the Cornwallis who founded Halifax got his training in terms of, you know, wiping people out and genocide, was genocide with the Scots. And this is how I know about him, because, 20 plus years ago, I went to Culloden, which was one of the final battles against the Jacobites in the mid 18th century, when it was the Highland Scots versus the English, let's say, or the British, the rest of the nation, and or the island at least. And Cornwallis was among the officers, I guess there you'd say. And the plan, it was just killing people on the battlefield, off the battlefield. They banned the kilt, they banned the bagpipes. If you wore that stuff or used it, you'd be punishable by death. They hunted people down, they burnt people alive, they burnt children. They didn't care. And then his next assignment, major assignment, was being sent to Halifax. It sounds like a buddy got him a job, and he applied the same skill set to the Mi'kmaq. It was like, kill any adult or child. Direct quote. So, what do you do with that? About 5 years ago in Halifax, Cornwallis Junior High was renamed Halifax Central Junior High. Mm. No hubbub then.
No.
No Proud Boys showing up saying you shouldn't do this, do that.
Right.
And the thing is, I thought about it a bit. If you look at the Proud Boys flag, which is the red ensign, which has what they consider to be the founding nations of Canada, the lily, the thistle, the shamrock, and the rose on the coat of arms. Cornwallis got his training against two of those people doing the same thing they did to the Mi'kmaq, in particular the lily, which was the French. In particular, the Acadians, he sort of engineered. He didn't actually get to do it because he was sent somewhere else because he was, sounds like, incompetent. The expulsion of the Acadians, which we, you know, were sent down the States. It's like, we don't want them there. We get rid of them. The Mi'kmaq. And, of course, the Scots, represented by the thistle on the flag. So this guy was actually against people that are on the red ensign, right?
He hated a lot of people.
Represented on that flag. So it's like, you got to get your history straight. This guy was a bad, bad number.
Well, that's the point, right?
Yeah.
It's not...
All around.
It's not Cornwallis's fault that the Proud Boys have sort of latched onto him, and it's not the Red Ensign. Like, the Red Ensign doesn't automatically become a racist symbol because racists...
It becomes a racist symbol because it's applied to it, but it's right. Like... It doesn't represent... It almost doesn't even represent what they're trying to say. You know
but
what I mean?
To the best of my knowledge, no one has called for the statue to be removed until now. Mm-hmm. To the best of my knowledge, the protest on Canada Day was nothing about tearing down the statue either. It was about, this is a bad dude who did bad things to the Mi'kmaq, and we're going to have this little ceremony. We're going to, you know, do a little incense. We're going to do, you know, say a few words in the hopes of fostering, you know, future, better action in the future through truth and reconciliation. Nobody was saying tear down this dude or anything like that, or we need to get rid of him and erase his name from the city foundry. Then who comes into the situation? The Proud Boys, and automatically politicizes this because they have taken this on. They've taken this on as an attack against whites, against Canadians, against men, for whatever reason. and they have made this instantaneously a political issue. And then so people who recognize the things that Cornwallis did, the bad things, and are automatically politicized to the opposite extreme end and saying, you know what? You're making this guy a hero. Get rid of it. Just tear it down. And and that's the end of it. And I don't think either answer. This guy shouldn't be commemorated. He shouldn't be. I don't think tearing down the statue and putting it away is the answer either. Because as you said, you can't. You're not going to open a book about Halifax and find Edward Cornwallis's name white. White it out.
I mean that would definitely be whitewashing history. But so what do you do then? Do you leave it there and put a disclaimer and say, by the way, this guy was a bit of a bastard to the peoples here?
Well, they could
and
do
back
that.
In the UK and in the it's context, right?
Well, they could put up a disclaimer, or some kind of history display or some kind of plaque that says, you know, in spite of the fact Edward Cornwallis founded the great city of Halifax, in which we are all proud to live, here's A, B, and C of the reality of
who he
was.
He offered a reward of 10 guineas granted for every Mi'kmaq taken or killed.
We don't even go into that detail.
Like, no, but this is the guy that we're dealing with.
Right. It's like, but even going into that detail, just like saying this is a man who was...
asterisks, by the way. There's some issues here.
Yeah, this is a man who promoted genocide against those who we now consider our First Nations neighbors, who we want are aiming to, you know, live and make a better future with.
And going back in history again as well, that from the motherland, that was what was told to Cornwallis initially when he got his posting. It was like, okay, you need to get along with these people. You need to get along with the French in the area and this and that. And it sounds like he just pretty much ignored them. It's like, no, we need this fort over here. So we're just going to get rid of them. So,
yeah. And this also brings us to Ryerson. And of course, Edgerton Ryerson is one of the people who sort of created the residential school system. He was I can't remember his exact position, but he was involved in developing the education of Ontario, the public education system of Ontario. And then they named a university after him. Makes sense. Worked in education, named a university after him. Mm-hmm. But he was also one of the guys that said, "Hey, here's an idea. Let's take a bunch of First Nations kids and, you know, make them more white." And then what happened, you know, at a lot of residential schools, kids went missing, straight up missing. Nobody cared. The kids who managed to make it out of residential school, most of them were horribly abused emotionally, physically, sexually. That's not a legacy you want to leave behind, at least in the modern context. But at the same time, I refer people back, you know, what's going to do the more... Or what's going to have a greater effect? Renaming a school after a guy who's long been dead and who's never going to change his ways, who's never going to apologize, or dealing with somebody like Lynn Beck, who said a few months ago, you know what, a lot of people forget the good that residential schools did. They just remember all the bad things. Yeah. So who should we be directing our ire at more, the dead guy or the living senator?
Well, they definitely won't be naming Ryerson after her, that's for sure. Hopefully not. I think this is the kind of change that needs to happen progressively, gradually. If they are really bound and determined to change the name of Ryerson, it's like... I think some of what's driving this in Canada now is the renaming of the Langevin Block. It's just a building, like it's a nondescript government building, but it's now the Indigenous headquarters in Ottawa, right? So you can't have it in the Langevin Block, so you rename it.
So that's something else that happened on the QT.
Well, no, but it's done now, right? It was formally announced on Canada Day, wasn't it? Or
yeah, but it was done. It didn't make the news. It didn't bring out the Proud Boys. Is what I'm saying.
Oh, so yeah, well, you're saying if they knew about it, but...
I mean, it wasn't a huge deal. It was just like, here's an announcement.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's a mad blogger somewhere got 20 pages on it, but we're not going to read that. but it's true, though. But if it's going to happen, significant change like this can happen. I'm sure some of the argument is like, well, I went to Ryerson, now my degree doesn't say Ryerson or whatever, but... If you look at the larger scheme of things, and not even just like the Saddam statues getting pulled down or the statues of Stalin or whoever getting pulled down, like statues or whatever, are they, you know, they have the significance that people apply to them, right?
Well, exactly.
But I was thinking about it, but I was thinking, okay, well, you know, if Bombay can be renamed and become Mumbai, or if Leningrad can become St. Petersburg again, or Cornwallis Junior High can go to Halifax Central Junior High, whatever it's called now. I mean, surely you can change these things without too much pain. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
So...
Well, you could, yeah, and that's the thing. And you pointed out that change happened in the case of the junior high, and there was not much fuss.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like getting rid of the indigenous symbols that they use for the Halifax chieftains, whatever they call the team. It's like those are disappearing too.
But then there's a case of something. I think it's Stanford where Woodrow Wilson was the president there, mm-hmm. and then they named a building after him because he was a president who became the president. But now people are petitioning for that change to happen because Woodrow Wilson, along with creating the League of Nations, which was the precursor to the United Nations, was also a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand, you know, and if you're a black person going to Stanford and you're going into the Woodrow Wilson building, I can understand some of the, you know, the mixed emotion you might be feeling about that. But, you know, at what point do we, account for people that there were antiquated thoughts in the heads of these people? I bet if you go back and spend enough time with any historical figure...
Mm-hmm.
Even the ones who aren't openly acknowledged as racist, chances are they are probably somewhat racist.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was just the toot of the time. And one thing I will add is I can't fully understand the emotion therein because I am a white dude. But at the same time, there is a spectrum of difference between someone like Cornwallis and somebody like, I don't know, just to pull a name out of my head, Hitler, or I mean, that's like end of the extreme,
Hitler,
right? Like, nobody's naming anything after Hitler anymore.
Hitler Street.
Right.
Would be changed right
or
away.
Or Jefferson. I mean, people talk about Jefferson having an affair with his slave, and it's like, mm-hmm. dude, if the slave is having an affair with the master, it's not an affair. It's rape. Because she's property. And so there's that attitude.
You change every Jefferson High in the U.S.? I don't know.
Jefferson Monument. Or mm-hmm. it's
Jefferson Airplane. Change your name.
Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it's just, you know, you go deep enough into any of these people from the past, I think you're going to find ugly things because history is ugly. And I don't think covering that up does, or trying to not cover it up in the negative sense of that, like we're doing a cover-up, but covering it up doesn't, I think, solve the problems in the present, because as we saw, these people come out of the dark, these Proud Boys. Did you ever hear of Proud Boys until 2 weeks ago?
No.
So, and again,
and
those protesters weren't doing anything more complicated. It's like, here's somebody with a past that is extremely negative to us. We want to move forward, so we're marking this with a ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And that was enough to get a bunch of angry white people and Gavin McInnes get their panties in a twist.
So well, they could do something like what they do in George Square in Glasgow, is that one of the statues always ends up with a road cone on its head. And it's become a thing. And like, even if it'll disappear, and then like overnight somebody will find a pylon and put it on this guy's head.
So, and that's one thing.
Yeah.
And
just mock them completely. So
that's one thing. That's an utterly harmless thing. And what I don't want to see is like people vandalizing stuff, which actually happened on the statue of Cornwallis. It's like that.
Oh, but now that it's got the crosshairs on, it's going to come down. It'll come down somehow.
It will.
Whether it be an administrative way or somebody will like
the mayor
light it up.
Yeah, the mayor, Mark.
Not that I'm encouraging that, folks, but I'm just saying
Mark
that's,
Savage, mayor of Halifax, great name, has pretty much admitted as much. He doesn't think it's going to happen. Like, they're having like a committee about it, about what to do with these kind of figures, but we'll see what happens. So we're going to take a break and then come back. And then we're going to talk about NAFTA and gender shifting aliens.
That's what they do.
It's that kind of show. We're going to talk about that after the break. We're going to play some music and we'll be right back. You're listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
My name is Mahmouda, and you are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
at the school. In the dark room at the school. The dark room at the school. You were my love, I was your fool. In the dark room at the school. In the dark room. In the dark room. The dark room at the school.
And I'm sure you guessed what that song was called. It's called The Dark Room at the School from Oh Susanna's new album called A Girl in Teen City. A bit of an introspective take there from Oh Susanna. She's been on the circuit for a while. And if you want to make out The Dark Room at the School here, you're going to have to do it soon because I think they're going to get rid of it. So pure upheaval in the UC.
What's the
here.
Album called?
It's called A Girl in Teen City.
Oh, I hate Teen City. Hate that place.
Teen City, isn't that like every city? There's Teen City a place. Teen City, here we come. And you say, speaking of here we come. Sorry, I gave you a segue that time because
I don't think this is a place you want to go either.
Speaking of Teen City.
Well, certainly some people are acting like teenagers in this city. Washington, D.C. So that's going to be where NAFTA renegotiations are going to begin on August the 16th. The Trump administration finally found room in its busy schedule of scandal after scandal.
And golf.
To finally hold these negotiations. So it seems to be, they released, the Trump administration released, I think it was a 19-page document that was kind of like a declaration of intent, like this is what we're going to be looking at. And to everyone's surprise, it was kind of not crazy, especially coming from the administration of the man who pretty much decided randomly a couple of months ago that he was going to just get completely out of NAFTA, that the United States was going to quit NAFTA.
And then after
a quick phone call with the presidents of Mexico, the president of Mexico and the prime minister of Canada, thought, okay, we'll renegotiate it instead.
Yeah, because I think they realize, or maybe somehow Trump and co. are beginning to realize how much is at stake. There's been a lot of not separate meetings, but parallel meetings. I think the premier's meeting this week was to talk a bit about this. And also, was it last week that Trudeau went to the governor's meeting, the yearly meeting in the States?
Yep.
And what was his speech had an interesting name. It was collaborating to create tomorrow's economy. So obviously, the dance is on, let's say. The talks, when was it, August 16th, you say? Mm-hmm. So there's still a little bit of time. Everybody can kind of get placed. And they've obviously, it's Leitzker, right? The main trade negotiator signed his name to the letter.
Yes, it was actually just approved, like, recently through the Senate. And it wasn't Democrats who were kind of holding him up. It was, John McCain and Ben Sasse, of all people, who were kind of had doubts about him.
So there's tons of things in it that have been outstanding issues. The big one, I think, for Canada, and as people are getting, I don't know about nervous, but that's causing a lot of talk, is the Chapter 19, which is the appeals board, I guess, where Canada, in particular the softwood file, has never lost, right? It just goes Chapter 19, it goes to the tribunal, and they say, no, America is being unfair in this instance. If I understand it right, I think Canada is has had the most challenges against it. In our NAFTA arrangement. Some of the other things that are in there, it was mentioned the integration of labor and environmental standards. And if that means what I think it means, it probably means that ours are going to get worse if that does happen. Because with that kind of stuff, it's always a race to the bottom where business is involved, in my opinion anyway. And also the bit about Buy America being an exempt and what are the exemptions, supply management is going to come up or has come up.
Yeah.
It was interesting. That was one of the governors, Scott Walker, seemed to be, who leans very right, he didn't sound sort of, I wouldn't say agitated, but you know that usual, like, we're going to cut the jobs, we're going to do this and that. He was just talking about Trudeau and Canada in a favorable light. Wisconsin being a dairy province, and there's lots there in terms of they're pretty much overproducing and want to dump it here.
Yeah.
Sorry if that sounded a bit like spin, but it's pretty true. So this is when supply management comes up over and over. And interestingly, and Canadians are going to love this, is the raising of the duty limit from $20 to $800. Mm-hmm. So if you go over to Niagara Falls to do your cross-border, I don't know how big, is cross-border shopping even as big a thing anymore as it used to be? Mm-hmm. You just go Amazon.
Yeah, I guess that's a good question.
That would probably carry over to Amazon as well if you ordered something from the States. Like they can't, they slap duty on things. It's just ridiculous, right?
I think when you'd the say, dollar was at parity, it was bigger. Or when it was close to parity.
It makes it worth your while to go to Syracuse and go shopping.
Right, but since then, I think the dollar's been hovering around 80 cents this week. So it's not terrible, but it's still not, you know, even close.
Yeah. Plus the duty, it'd just kill you.
Plus stuff like Black Friday have moved north. I mean, pretty much Canada has a Black Friday, even though the term is meaningless here.
Or Boxing Week in July was when I saw.
Boxing Week in July.
Let's just have everything on sale all the time.
Yeah.
With no duties and no tariffs, because nobody likes those.
That's an interesting thing. The Chapter 19 thing, it's because that fits right into what they've been doing with softwood lumber by, you know, throwing extra tariffs on it and extra regs, which have slowed that market down, especially in the midst of a strong economic stuff going on in the States, mm-hmm. and a lot of building going on, a lot of lumber that the American lumber market can't meet, so they're kind of hurting themselves as well. The dairy market thing, the spin of it is they want to, quote-unquote, open themselves up. They want to sell to new markets, but I don't think that what you said is the spin. I think that's the reality, is that mm-hmm. we are overproducing. You know, no one's got a gun to their head, so to speak.
No.
That you know, you have to be.
Well, it's America,
more
though,
cows.
So it's quite possible. No, but no, but there's loopholes to that too, where they can send up powdered milk, and it counts as a different category. It was kind of like when they were wrapping cigarettes in cigarette leaves, cheroots, and then they become taxed differently, and then that loophole gets closed. So everybody's looking for an in for their stuff.
Yes, and then...
That's not in a nutshell. Everybody's looking to sell their stuff.
But at the same time, a lot of these governors want to make sure that Canadian and Mexican companies can't bid on on contracts within the state, that they want to make sure that state agents, state businesses are able to bid on contracts first. This is going to be a tricky thread to needle, because this was... Made in America week at the White House with a president who's
wearing a baseball hat made in China. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to be making baseball hats in America. It's America.
Sure.
Maybe they make custom classy ones. Boutique
hats. Artisanal baseball
hats. Artisanal. Not the $10 one you get from the guy with the little street display.
So, I mean, it's tricky. How do you thread the needle in terms of protecting your own economy from people who want to sell into your market, and then how do you convince them not to act otherwise? How do you get into their marketplaces when you're being a protectionist? So this is a very delicate process they're going to have to undertake. And I got to find this person's name. I always write down names, and then I can never find them in my notes. But somebody
you should see our notes, people. Oh, my goodness.
Somebody in the Financial Post wrote that these are going to be delicate negotiations. And if there's one thing, and this is kind of where I've added my attitude, is like he made this point, these are going to be delicate negotiations. American negotiators are going to have to be nimble. They're going to have to make compromise. And then what we're seeing right now in the States is the negotiation over health care reform, which is also requires the same thing, because you're dealing with desperately different points of view, desperately different demands, just within the same party. And what have we seen? We've seen an utter and complete failure to accomplish anything. And the devil's in the details. And the details isn't where Donald Trump lives. Donald Trump lives in the big idea conceptual phase. He lives in the idea of, I want a big tower that's 59 stories tall and have gold fixtures everywhere. And then it's up to other people to like drop the plans and to hire the contractors and to lay the foundation and to do it. He's
an ideas man.
Yeah, he's an ideas man.
Yeah.
So my question is, what happens if, you know, and this is a really tight deadline too. They think they want to have something done in 4 months.
No way.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's just that's my opinion.
Scotty says no way.
No way.
They want to have something done in 4 months. And my question is, what's going to happen when they maybe get an agreement, in, whether it's in 4 months or 5 months. And then they take it back to 45, and he's like,
I'm not signing this.
It's like, so we're not getting rid of it? Or, like, how does this change anything? Like, how is this different from the past agreement? How is this better? And then they're going to start trying to explain it to him, and then he's going to see his name flash across the screen on Fox and Friends, and he's going to get distracted by a bumblebee. It's really kind of vexing in terms of where they think they want to go on this, because it seems like there's an agreement here, or there's a possibility here that this just might be a smooth process, and just maybe a couple of quick nips and tugs. But
I think they need to do a draft version with his name in it a lot, make it look like his idea, and then when they give him the permanent one to sign, like the official one, just say, oh, it's almost the same as the draft. You don't have to read it. Because I don't know how else. I really don't. If the final say is his, if it isn't just down to Congress and the Senate, it's going to be a challenge.
I don't want to give Donald Trump too much credit, because I don't think they have to tell him. He doesn't have to read something. He's not going to read something.
No, he won't read it. Just bullet points, right? And even that, I don't know.
Well,
put it on Fox News. Right? I get them to deliver it. So I deliver the manifesto by whoever, whatever his favorite talking head is, and then might get his attention. I don't know. But keep saying his name. I hear that's... Where was I reading that? That's
everywhere.
The thing you have to do with Trump is just keep saying it.
And so, I want to point out, too,
Donald, that
the United States isn't the only one having problems. That a lot of people are pointing out that this media blitz that the conservatives are on. Michelle Rempel was on Tucker Carlson's show.
Oh.
Somebody, I think it was Joe Oliver, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about Omar Khadr and the settlement, and about how, like, Canadians are in an uproar about this, an uproar.
And Mulroney's making the rounds again, talking trade, right? I don't know if that's why he went and sang Irish Eyes Are Smiling again.
Well, they've been kind of leaning on Mulroney, which is interesting. The Liberals, I mean. The Liberals are playing this in a very interesting way, and I think a much better way than the Americans. You have even the Saskatchewan Chamber of Commerce, like, doing outreach. Like, Regina, the Regina Saskatoon Chamber.
So it's kind of like the governors versus the state, or governors versus the federal.
Right.
We've got the
And you have Kathleen Wynne and the Ontario government doing outreach cross-border to, you know, to states that Ontario borders with. You have Justin Trudeau at the governor's conference. So
pulling out all the stops.
Yeah, and then in the meantime, you have the conservatives trying to make hay out of Omar Khadr, which... only kind of undermines because...
What was that fake news thing that was talking about fake news, the elite? Oh, my goodness.
Classic stuff. Yeah.
The MP
Rebel.
That came up.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yikes.
Yeah. I don't think you make any bones going on Tucker Carlson, Michelle Rempel.
No.
He used to be mildly amusing when he wore bow ties all the time, but now he's just kind of a jerk. But... Anyway, speaking of jerks...
those nerds are sitting at CFRU.
Yeah, we're kind of dipping into pop culture territory, which is what I do on my other CFRU show, but...
It's the ultimate crossover in this one.
It's the ultimate crossover. Should have had Candace in. It was announced last Sunday, the new Doctor, and if you don't know who the Doctor is, Doctor Who is kind of a niche-y kind of cult program here in Canada. It's pretty big in the UK, though. I think it's probably between James Bond and the Doctor as, like, the biggest British pop culture character.
Iconic, at least, yeah.
Yeah, iconic. Yeah. But the Doctor, the main character of the show, changes faces every now and then, and the new face it's changing into is a lady face. An actress named Jodie Whittaker is going to play the new Doctor in Doctor Who, and wouldn't you know it, and I love this tweet, somebody put it out, a bunch of men who have never watched Doctor Who are outraged today, because there's a woman in a role, and there are a number of, like, different angles to see this from. One, of course, it's just a pure kind of, you know, relief that something people have been calling for a while, to have someone who's female or a person of color in the role, which has been, for the previous 12 incarnations, been a white dude. The second angle is, you know, it gives young women who previously watching Doctor Who have only been able to see themselves as the sidekick, now can see themselves as the hero. And then there was an article in the Irish Times that was interesting. Somebody said, you know what, this maybe isn't the progress people think it is, because you're taking a role that has traditionally been a male and casting a female to play it, which feels like progress, but perhaps it's false progress, because the ideal is to more make a great original female character.
Well, I mean, they've been hinting at this for ages. And when I say ages, I mean like 30, however many years, some of the comments that other doctors have made, I think when Tom Baker, who is the, if you've never seen any Doctor, you'll know Tom Baker. He's like the iconic one that they put in The Simpsons when they're talking Doctor Who, yeah, or whatever, or Family Guy. It's the guy with the scarf. The guy with the scarf and the floppy hat.
Yeah.
And he said, lots of luck to the man or woman who replaces me, something like that. And in the most recent episodes, it was implied. What was it that in the finale he said was... there was a very pointed comment by the not current Doctor anymore. I guess it's Christmas time. I've completely lost my train of thought there, but
you
I will find.
You mean Capaldi?
Capaldi. Oh no, I know who Capaldi is, but oh, he said, here it is. He said, "We Time Lords are billions of years beyond your petty obsession with gender and its associated stereotypes. They've been dropping clues in the show for ages. We've also seen, you know, the Master." This is really for fan people I'm talking to here, because the Master is the Doctor's arch rival. The Master, yeah, went female for the past several episodes, if not a couple of seasons. Mm-hmm. And then they had this interesting collision of the male Master and the female Master coming back and being in the same timeline, which I thought everything blew up when that happened. But it seems it doesn't.
You're thinking of Time Cop.
It seems it doesn't sometimes. The streams must not cross. And then another show of the cult show was Torchwood. Did you watch Torchwood? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where Captain Jack, who was also in Doctor Who,
was
a companion for a while. He was pretty much pansexual.
Yeah.
So it's been hinted at for ages that something like this was going to happen, and yet, you know, not everybody's. It sounds like this. It's something to the tune of 15% of people are like against this. Whose heads exploded when they found out, like, it's going to be a woman. And da, da, da. I just hope she gets to keep her Yorkshire accent. I don't know if you've heard her speak, but it's like, she's got this great kind of lack, you know, don't you know? And then that's that stuff like that, to me, makes it interesting. But I mean, I like when Doctor Who delves into social comment. I think this is along those lines. I think it's going to be prominent for the kickoff and maybe a little bit into it. And then I think people are just going to let it go. Because, yeah, interestingly, it sounds like the Christmas episode is going to be like Doctor One is coming back.
Well, so it's going to be like the first. He's not coming back because passed away a long time ago.
No, no, no. It's like the third guy to play him or something. But
yeah,
David Bradley.
David,
there you go. You know the name, so probably bigger
also
fan.
Also known as Walder Frey on Game of Thrones. And he was also the caretaker in the Harry Potter movies.
I think this needs
Filch.
This needs another 20 minutes on your other show. End credits, but it's not a movie yet, but it might very well be. So,
well, you know, we talk about a lot of things, but yeah, it's I found it interesting because it was kind of done really subtly. They didn't try to make a big deal out of it. The mere fact that it was done, it was a big deal, but the announcement itself wasn't a big deal.
It was this weird reveal after Wimbledon or something.
It's it was done after Wimbledon, which is weird because and this the previous Doctor Who season ended a couple of weeks ago. You thought that would have maybe been the time, but that's okay. I thought it was kind of a big deal when they hired Peter Capaldi a couple of years ago because he's an older gentleman.
Yeah,
and because since the show was brought back, Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant, Matt Smith, the emphasis is kind of on younger. I mean, Christopher Eccleston wasn't that young, but I mean, he was certainly younger on the younger side. He didn't have any gray hairs. You know, Peter Capaldi, head full of gray hair. So that was even just like, in terms of the modern context, just showing an older doctor was kind of revelatory, even though it was still a white dude. So now going into, you know, a 35-year-old woman, it will be interesting to see how that changes the dynamic, because I think Michelle Gomez brought certain things to the Master that previous people, playing the master couldn't, because
she was excellent.
She was excellent, and as soon as you put a woman in that role, it changes things fundamentally.
She just flew with it, and that's good casting, really, right? You say, who are we going to get to do this?
And that was done subtly, too. They introduced the character at the beginning of one of the seasons, and you don't find out till the end that she is the master. And in that moment, I don't remember any sort of MRA guys going like, "Master's a woman. This is ridiculous," or anything like that.
Yeah, and I think that was a heavy clue as well. I was like, "This is coming." By the way, you know, the master can be a woman.
It was totally a test drive.
Yeah, exactly. And people loved her. I think.
By that point, people were like, Missy is awesome. And I think like you said, this is going to, I think first of all, it was kind of like a ratings ploy, because the series has been dipping in the ratings lately.
Well, because it stunk for a while there, I think. And that's just my view of the way it was written. I mean, they brought back the Mondas Cybermen. I mean, that's, they're the coolest in my book, because they're so creepy.
That was niche-y.
It's for fans for sure. Cause they're, you know, it's for like long running fans or people that, I'm not one of them, but like own all the DVDs and all the and read the book, the books and stuff, and magazines and follow stuff online. That's who that was for, because it wouldn't mean a lot. They, you know, they look like they were wearing tensor bandages and have a flashlight on their head, but they nailed it, because that super creepy voice. And supposedly that was a request of Peter Capaldi to bring them back, because he loved them when he was a kid. He was that age, right? So when you get to play the Doctor, I guess you have some sway. You're not the showrunner, and it'll change now that Stephen Moffat isn't the brains, the showrunner.
Right, that's
it.
The other...
Because I don't know. It's mine.
He has a tendency towards Deus Ex TARDIS, which is just like science magic solves everything. But the other thing is to remember, they're also changing producers. A man named Chris Chibnall is taking over. He is he's very well known for having created Broadchurch, which of course Jodie Whittaker was one of the main characters on. So this is kind of a writer-actress relationship that has been sort of codified over the last couple of years.
And it's a pretty dark show, isn't it?
It's a dark show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's about you know, murder in a small town, and Whittaker had, you know, the worst the role on it, which is the mother of the dead child in season one. Mm-hmm. So, it might be nice for her to do something fun and a bit more lighter for a change. And the other thing I wanted to address really briefly was, this is another example of the greatness of social media and the toilet of social media. And interesting, on the same day or later that night, we had Ed, speaking of Game of Thrones, we had Ed Sheeran making a cameo on Game of Thrones.
Did you see that? How was it? I don't watch Game of Thrones.
The season premiere?
Yeah.
It was good. It was a good sort of setup episode for...
How was Ed Sheeran? Was he just like visiting? He's like, I'm going to play a little song.
Sitting around a campfire. he was a Lannister soldier sitting around a campfire with other Lannister soldiers, just chilling out when Arya Stark comes along. And he's singing a song, and the song wasn't one of his. It was actually a song that was from one of the J.R.R. Martin books. It was one of these little allegorical songs that makes you think it's like foreshadowing or something. But so Ed Sheeran is sitting there. But of course, people go nuts. It's like, what is Ed Sheeran doing about Game of Thrones? It's ridiculous. And he deletes his account because
he's got completely harassed by that.
And I was sitting there watching that, and I was like, is that Ed Sheeran? Oh, that's nice. Game over.
No blood pressure pills required. It just happened, and that was it. So
Did
we talk about anything political in the past 12 minutes? I guess so. I don't know.
Well, we talked around it.
It's Doctor Who, the most political show on television.
It's summer.
Politically charged, anyway. But yeah, so.
It's summer. Nobody's listening.
Yeah, we should do this more often. The fourth topic will be just whatever.
Well, usually we have people in the back half of the show, and we haven't had people in the last couple of weeks, but we're trying to get more people. One of them is Liz Sandals. She will be here on August the 10th. And we're going to keep on keeping on and trying to get some more.
And we'll get the new Doctor Who on.
I'll
put that appeal in. So I got a connection to the BBC. So
speaking of connections, stay connected to Open Sources all week long at opensourcesguelph.com. Open Sources Newswire on the Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on the Twitter. And find this and other fine podcasts on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or subscribe through iTunes or Stitcher. I'll be back here next week at 10 a.m. on a Thursday for End Credits. That's your movie news and review show. And you can connect with me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson or go to GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scott Hertz on Facebook, Scott Hertz on Twitter. The blog is at spannerbook.wordpress.com. Or if you Google Spannerbook, it's the first thing that comes up. I picked a pretty good name.
Wow, well done.
Yeah.
Way to maximize your SEO.
The hit. I don't know. Anyway, might be something this weekend.
All right, well, you've been warned. And here's a warning for you. DJ sounds good to me. I believe maybe a repeat. We don't see her outside lurking, waiting to get in. But we'll have more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here next week, Thursday at 5 p.m. See you then.